This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. How can music be used as therapy to treat and manage symptoms of autism spectrum disorder? Dr. Indra V. Selvaraja, a medical music therapist and lecturer over at University Putra Malaysia's music department, explains this as well as the many other benefits of music therapy. Welcome to the show, Dr. Indra.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me, Lin.
So the first question then is, what is music therapy? I mean, it sounds like a relatively simple phrase, but how does it work?
Music therapy is actually a research and clinically based form of music intervention that has been developed specifically to harness the potential of music in all its forms and possibilities to actually create and trigger therapeutic benefits. And what I mean by that, of course, is everybody has a personal connection to music. Everyone has the potential to respond to music. And so as music therapists, we actually receive training to see how we can shape that response, how we can enhance and enlarge a person's ability to react to the variety of acoustic properties, stimulative and sedative qualities in the music, and to see how we can fit in the musical intervention to larger objectives. And most of the time, those objectives are not musically based, but they are meant to either rehabilitate or to restore normal functioning in the human being.
So when you say, you know, everybody has a personal connection to music, I mean, that's something that, you know, anybody who enjoys music, I think, will understand.
Right.
But so when you kind of translate that into trying to harness the power of music, are we looking at qualities that are inherent in a song or in a tune, or is it are we looking more for the reactions of people to that piece of music?
Both and more. So the fact that most people will have a song that's either personally meaningful, like if I ask you, what are the types of music that you like, and whether you have any favorite songs, there's going to be certain memories, certain times of personal connection to the song that have to do with the music itself. Perhaps you like the arrangement, you like the melody, the quality of the voice. All these are properties that are inherent in the music. We also talk about the psychoacoustic aspects of it, which are part and parcel of the music. But you also talk about that human element where a person will have their own special reason for liking the song. And as therapists, we try to tap into that. We try to find out what is that personal connection and how we can actually ride on that to open up a host of possibilities for counseling, for encouraging the person to engage and interact on a deeper level with the music. And ultimately, our goal is usually non-musical, which perhaps is quite surprising for people.
So take me through it then. If I'm here for a session of music therapy, what can I expect?
Well, the first thing that we usually do is to get a form of assessment. And that assessment would be the therapist's attempt to find out what is it about music that you enjoy, what types of music you like. And usually what precedes the actual assessment is a referral. So, for example, my main specialty is medical music therapy. So in the hospital setting, someone may have been identified as maybe having depression, is having issues with pain management, perhaps you're feeling very anxious about the medical procedures that lie ahead. So a doctor or a nurse may actually make a referral and say that, hey, you know, this person is not really feeling too well. We are worried that they may be having an anxiety attack, or they're not very cooperative. They might be combative. So can you, as a music therapist, go in and assess them, find out what is ailing them, and to see whether you can use music to soothe them and to help them to reach a state of equilibrium so that they are ready to receive medical treatment?
What are the different forms of music therapy then?
Well, music therapy is extremely diverse and versatile. And ever since its inception, there have been so many different applications in a range of different settings. We deal with people from the womb to the tomb, literally. And what that means is everything from premature infants all the way up to mental health, to music and child development, which is one of my areas as well as looking into mental health and counselling, substance abuse. We look at applications of music in nursing homes with older adults, all the way to death and bereavement. So basically, the different forms of music therapy are all geared towards catering to each and every one of those settings.
So looking at autism in particular, then, you know, just narrowing in, how does music therapy help to manage autism?
There are many research proven benefits of using music therapy as a treatment modality for autism. One of the things that is really, really powerful is we know that a typical symptom of autism is that kids tend to be socially inhibited. They tend to have a sense of lower self-esteem, lack of social confidence, and perhaps they are typically evasive in terms of eye contact. They tend to be less communicative. And so all these things are the symptoms that we will hone in on. And how we use music is to try to create that kind of safe platform, something that's non-threatening, to help them to explore, to express themselves, and also to learn in the process. And we focus on their strengths rather than their disability, because a lot of time when we talk about kids with special needs, people will tend to be more aware of what are their limitations.
What they seem to be lacking in order to function in normal
society.
As if,
you know, there's something that is somehow not right, weak, and perhaps incomplete about them. So that can be a very depressing kind of situation to be in. And we know that mental health issues are also quite big with special needs. So as music therapists, we would go into that situation, create that safe platform. I mentioned it was non-threatening. But we'll also try to create a motivating and engaging environment to encourage them to not just enjoy music, but in the process of interacting and engaging with the music activities, they would actually overcome their fears, they would develop more openness, and they would feel more relaxed to be themselves. And that's really powerful. Because once that platform of trust is created, then we as therapists can start to bring in the different educational goals. Perhaps we may be working on communication skills. We may be working on helping them to expand their social appropriate behaviors. And these are things that you can literally stimulate and recreate in a musical environment. And ultimately, our goal is to teach them these behaviors, help them to develop those skills to transfer outside of the music context, because that's where it's really important.
We've done shows before on dance therapy, and that seems to me to be something that could be related. I mean, it's dance, it's music. Do you work often with dance therapists or other forms of therapy?
Absolutely, because music is so malleable, and music often functions as a backdrop, a partner to many, many different types of activities. So we frequently work with speech therapists. That's really a big area. And we talk about things like stroke rehabilitation, where communication is lost, and they are actually compromised in terms of their ability to speak, to express themselves. It's a very sad, but also a very inevitable symptom. Then we would work in conjunction with the speech therapist, for example, to try to rebuild their speech and memory. And it's possible to do that using singing activities, using a variety of other music and rhythm activities to just help to rehabilitate their speech, for example. We work with dance therapists with music and movement. That's something that flows together very naturally. And we focus more on how we can use the qualities of music to enhance, to support, and even motivate the patient to be able to go further and to be able to do more. Because sometimes, so for example, as a medical music therapist, I frequently work in physical rehab. And what happens is you find it's so difficult to get patients to engage in physical rehabilitation and to keep that consistent regime, which is so important for that rehabilitation. And so music becomes a motivator. It also becomes a way to distract them from pain. Just like when we go to the gym, and I'm allergic to exercise personally, and I can only do gym because there's music. And if I like the music, I find myself doing more because it actually encourages me to stay longer on the treadmill, for example, or to pace myself using the rhythm and the beat in the music. And it enhances the effectiveness of my exercise. So in the same way, we often use music as a motivating force, as a way to pace and regulate movement, and in the process, enhance your rehab.
The notion of music as a healing force, as something of power, as something that can move you, has a long history over time. I mean, if not, you wouldn't see music being incorporated into religious activities, for instance. But as you say, music therapy is, it's medical, it's scientific, you know, it's quantifiable. So how did music therapy, as it's understood today, as it's practiced today, begin and develop?
Actually, of course, if you go back to the ancient world, you hear a lot of mention of music being used for its stimulative and sedative qualities. Even as far back as the Greek philosophers, you have Aristotle, you have Plato, and Hippocrates, who is the forefather of medical field as we know it today. And he was actually using music with his mental patients, as much as they believed that music was able to affect the emotions and even help to develop character. And what we found is, down the line, I'm not going to go back too much into the history because you're asking me about the contemporary application. During World Wars I and II, this is when music therapy really started in the US. And what happened is you had all these veterans coming back from the field and they were injured. They would have to undergo long and painful bouts of rehabilitation in hospital. And so what they tried to do to boost their morale and to entertain them, because you can imagine many of them are in pain, they are suffering a lot of PTSD, which is something that even occurs today. And so they tried to bring in bands, they tried to bring in musicians just to entertain the patients. But what was very surprising is they actually found that in the process, not only were these veterans responding positively to the music, their treatment actually became more efficient. And they were actually receiving physiological, emotional benefits as well as improving faster. So that actually spurred the demand from doctors and nurses, people who work with these veterans, to bring in more musicians. And it's really interesting because there is an account in 1789 where the first music therapy mention was made in a periodical. It was called Columbia Magazine. And they talked about how music could be physically considered. And they were exploring the actual effects of music therapy. So it's like the mention has actually occurred earlier. I'm mentioning 1789. And there's also a lot of activity in the 1800s. Because this is when medical doctors, specifically, were starting to recognize the benefits of music. So there is this history in the States where observations being made from the medical field, also in the field of psychiatry. And ultimately, when music was used in hospitals during World War I and II, that actually spurred such an increase in demand that they actually started to develop training programs. So that's how today they have about 72 different institutions in the States that offer music therapy training. But it's really important to emphasize that there's a whole history that underlies the practice of music therapy. And this comes as much from ancient history as much as modern day history. And what we have inherited today is something that is the legacy of all that work that has gone on. But right now, what has happened is, of course, it has been enhanced scientifically, medically, and we bring in a lot of psychology, we bring a lot of counselling in to the equipping. So it's very much a multidisciplinary field.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Indra V. Selvaraja, medical music therapist from University Putra, Malaysia. We are discussing music therapy and autism. Up next, the kinds of music that are appropriate for use in therapy, as well as exploring more about the role of music therapy in our lives and minds. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me is Dr. Indra V. Selvaraja, medical music therapist from University Putra, Malaysia. We are discussing music therapy. So what kinds of music are appropriate for use in therapy, or is it a grab bag? Anything goes.
Well, music therapy, the understanding is that whatever works for the patient or client is potentially something that we would use. So part of the challenge of the training is you have to be as exposed as possible. I remember when I was in the States, one of the hardest things for me to do was hip-hop. But you have to go with that, because depending on what makes that personal connection to the client, there's so much that is available today, especially with, you know, globalization and the variety of music that's available. We're not just talking about pop music on the radio. We're talking about all the different permutations of music, the different genres that basically are representative of so many different interests and tastes. So as a music therapist, part of our job is to try to figure out what is personally meaningful and what will work best for the client, and to go with it, and that means everything.
And on the flip side of that, there's heavy metal music has been known to be used as a torture device or an interrogation technique. And it's funny because, I mean, what you just said is like you need to try and figure out what someone has a connection to and what would work. But I can imagine even someone having a real connection to heavy metal music really struggling with having it bombarded into an enclosed space for 24 hours a day. So when does music cross that line? You know, how can you use music in, I suppose, a more negative fashion?
Well, as music therapists, of course, our main goal is to find positive benefits. But I always joke about the fact that, you know, the flip side to being a music therapist is you can be a music terrorist. But more seriously, when we look at something like heavy metal, and of course we know lyrics can potentially be looked at from a negative point of view if, for you know, perhaps the content itself has very clear and direct references that may be considered as socially inappropriate. But what we do is try to maintain an objective and neutral stance. And for example, there's something called hip-hop therapy. And what they do with that, which is really remarkable, is they use hip-hop lyrics that reflect a lot of the struggles that African-American youth go through. And we talk about, even now, you know, what we hear about the police confrontations, the racial stereotyping. These things are problems today that some of these youth confront. But looking at music, and specifically the hip-hop lyrics, as a social mirror, and to use that as a means to open up that conversation, to get the youth to engage, and to open up whatever issues they may have in their life. It's something liberating about looking at a song, and perhaps it has negative themes. And of course, we're not trying to reinforce any socially negative behaviours, but to give the client the permission to be themselves and to express and to explore what their angst is, what their struggles are, what their problems are. And that may mean allowing them to draw up things in their life that are negative. So when you bring a song that has so-called negative lyrics, but if you feel that song speaks into the experience of that particular client, you're giving the person permission to be themselves. And then starting from there, what we would do as therapists is try to shape their response, to get them to explore in a non-judgmental way what are their connections to the song lyrics and how it explains certain problems, for example, that may have occurred in their life. So I love the fact that in hip-hop therapy, for example, they use lyrics to actually bring up themes of gun violence, of street and neighborhood confrontations, about the fact that sometimes people die young. It's not uncommon among African-American youth. Teenage pregnancies. Now, these are all issues that are very real, but often difficult to talk about. And if you're dealing with an at-risk youth who has an issue like that, it's really, really going to be difficult to get them to open up and to share that experience and say, yes, you know, I got pregnant when I was 16, you know. And so how do you use that song as that non-confrontational platform to get them to engage, to look at the words and say, this is me, this is my story? And that immediately helps to break the ice. And if you're helping them to explore the themes in a way that enables them to not only draw the connections, but to open up and share what their problems are in response to the lyrics, then you're already halfway there in being able to give them the kind of counselling they need and to get them to perhaps explore solutions for problem solving, to question their behaviours and their choices, and to ultimately guide them through the process to make empowered decisions. So as therapists, we do not subscribe to using music as a means to negatively impact the clients, but we do go with whatever material has the potential to lead the client from a dark place, something that perhaps, I mean, we talk about someone that's going through depression. There's nothing pleasant about it. And we want to be able to enter into the experience with them so that they feel supported, they feel that there is somebody there for them. And it's, this somebody is not there to condescend on them, not there to judge them, but really to be there alongside them from a position of empathy, and then to gradually guide them towards a healthier response.
Listening to music and enjoying music, mm-hmm, and being good at it are really two entirely separate things. I think I can speak very personally on this. You know, you can enjoy music very much while not being able to create much of it at all. So how much of musical, I wouldn't say talent, but affinity, do you need to really respond well to music therapy?
That's a very, very interesting question. The fact that we all have such a connection to music. If you think about the way that kids are socialized, right from young, mothers sing lullabies to their babies. So music becomes this intimate connection that often helps to enhance the bond between mother and child, because they are being sung to, helped to sleep, and then eventually the soundtrack of their growing up years will always be accompanied by some form of musical activity. And if you think about festivities, for example, you know, there's going to be so much that we connect with festive music. I can't think of Chinese New Year without, you know, all this Chinese New Year music, Chinese New Year carols, as I like to call them.
Carols, the drums.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can imagine that everybody grows up with so much music in their environment that they have been socialized and conditioned in some form or other to respond to music. Never mind the fact that very often rhythm is a driving force in music, and it already coordinates with our pulse, with the way our body physiologically responds. So we all have that potential for connection with music. The difference between someone who is a trained musician and one who is not is that the trained musician would receive more structured and comprehensive exposure to musical training. And I truly believe, because I teach music and child development, everybody has the potential to learn music and to become proficient at it, at least at a level where it either enhances their personal enjoyment or even to a point where, for those who are particularly gifted, they can actually turn it into a career. So I don't believe that people are not able to learn music because there's a lot of research to show that given the right exposure and opportunity, everybody benefits from music. And it doesn't mean they have to necessarily become advanced musicians.
So in a therapy session, does the healing mostly come from creating music or responding to music?
Both. We try to engage people with music on whatever level seems to be most fitting for their particular therapeutic goal. So, for example, we may use what we call receptive music listening. And that is when you allow a patient to listen to music that's been pre-selected and to react to it and to respond to it on whatever level is seen as fit. I've worked with patients who are in coma, and in that situation, you're trying to use music as a stimulus and to see whether you can get a reaction out of them that will suggest there is some kind of brain activity and their ability to respond to the music. So that's very much on a basic level of response. But we go all the way to using music for song lyric analysis, as I mentioned, for counselling, and we even use music activities where we incorporate instruments, which requires a higher level of engagement, because now they don't just listen to it, they play, they shake, they move. They have to do something with the music along with the therapist, and they have to learn to coordinate their responses. But we go to the other end where we actually use songwriting, and we get people to express what they are feeling, what they're thinking, as a means to process their experience. And when you put it in song, song itself requires a certain structure and pattern. Usually there's a climax with a chorus, there's going to be verses, and so they get to tell their story in that narrative. But in that process, they are able to also send a message out. And when they sing it, it just amplifies the emotional aspect of it and helps them to internalize what they are saying and express it at the same time in a way that we hope that whole message will sink in and affect the individual as much as they may be expressing it to someone else. So it covers a wide range, and songwriting is also frequently used where we are creating music.
So what's involved in coming up with a music therapy program? How do you decide, okay, this person I think would benefit from some time with the tambourine, and you would benefit from some time, writing down some lyrics? How do you decide who gets what, I suppose, and also how you progress from receptive listening to active participation?
It all goes back to the referral and assessment. So usually music therapists work in a multidisciplinary team. So for example, when I was in the hospital, I would be involved in the coronary heart unit. I was involved in the stroke unit, and we became a part of the team. So every week when they have their case management meetings, I would be in attendance. And it's during that process when their main medical treatment is being discussed, the progress of the patients are actually being examined. That is when the therapist would be either giving input or working alongside the main medical team to decide what would be in the best interest of the client. So it's very rare in a proper setting where the music therapist acts as a single agent. But of course, in a place like Malaysia, very often we have independent referrals. And what happens then is you as a therapist have to go in and use your own skills to try to assess and to attempt to figure out what would be the best way to intervene with this client. And there are quite a few music therapists who are out there, actually. I'm very encouraged to see that since I've come home, there are about 10 of us. One or two who are based overseas, one's actually studying in NYU, and another one who's just finishing up her master's in the UK. And we are actually all going to be presenting at this seminar that's going to be at the end of the month.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that because there's UPM Music Cares, right?
That's right.
Yes, you're organizing a seminar on May 29th and 30th. Mm-hmm. So we now know there are 10 talks planned, is that right?
There's going to be 12 altogether because what I tried to do was bring in the music therapists and give them a chance to share from their perspectives of training because they all come from different backgrounds of training. Some of them are from Australia, most of them actually. There are a couple from the UK. I myself am trained in the US. And so I thought it would be advantageous to the participants to be able to hear from all these different perspectives. And the unique thing about these therapists is they are Malaysians, and they have been working with Malaysians. And most access that we have to music therapy is actually based on research or clinical work that's done overseas, which may or may not be wholly applicable when you're dealing with a Malaysian context. So this is one of the strengths, I believe, of this seminar. But the other part of it is I've also brought in a special education expert, a medical doctor, who are able to give a wider perspective of how music can be used in special education because I didn't want it to be too restrictive and I wanted it to be a multidisciplinary approach and to give people as much access as possible to know not only from a music therapy perspective but from a more holistic perspective because there are many, many who are already using music in special education. This is one of the things I found out when I was researching the background for the seminar. But many of them may not be trained or qualified to use music, but they are well-intentioned and they see the potential in music. So we wanted to reach out to them with as wide and comprehensive approach as possible. And it meant bringing in people from different disciplines.
So who should attend the seminar?
We are targeting mainly parents, caregivers, organizations, institutions who work with autistic kids. And we are hoping that this seminar, which is meant to equip and empower them, will give them the tools, the kind of insight into the ways that they can use music to enhance their existing services. I've also had a lot of requests. Some of them are quite heartbreaking, really, from parents who are individually seeking what's best for their kids, but don't necessarily have access to the range of services available. And they have come saying, you know, look, we really, really want to be able to do our best for our kids. We know music is something they use overseas. Is there a way for us to get information, to get the kind of training? And I realized that I can go and see them one-to-one, but the level of outreach is limited. So through a seminar like this and bringing in all the different experts, I myself will be presenting as well, but together with the other therapists, I'm hoping that the network of support can be formed that will actually create a much wider outreach. And also, what is really important is we hope to initiate the work through this seminar. One component of this seminar, which is very unique but important, is we're actually going to have action group meetings. And what that means is after the 1.5 days of presentations, research workshops, clinical training, we will actually be having meetings for the therapists and the other presenters to come together and sit down with the participants and to have a discussion and to try to initiate groundwork, to find a way to commit to what they have heard. Because very often when I've been to seminars, you have the exposure, you have the information, and then after that you come to the end and everybody says bye-bye, you know, let's stay in touch, and then you go back and then you forget about it, or everybody becomes so busy with their daily lives. So this is an opportunity to really get the participants to sit down after all that education, after all that training, and to work with the therapist and to see what we can actually do to carry forward some of the learning from the seminar and translate it into actual action that can benefit the special needs community.
And where can people go to get more information?
They can actually use this email. There's upmmusiccares@gmail.com. And if they just shoot me an email, I'll be at hand to give them more information. The other alternative is to go to our Facebook page. We have a Facebook page specially set up for this. It's called UPM Music Cares. And you will be connected to the student secretariat who are working under me. And we will be happy to forward the brochure, more information about the event, as well as to answer any questions that you may have.
Wonderful. So again, UPM Music Cares is organising a seminar on May 29th and 30th. And if you'd like to reach out, that email address again?
upmmusiccares@gmail.com.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Indra. I've been speaking with Dr. Indra V. Selvaraja, medical music therapist from University Putra Malaysia. We've been discussing music therapy in general and how it can help people with autism in particular. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.